You were the change. You answered people's hopes, and because of you, by almost every measure, America is a better, stronger place than it was when we started.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're looking at the transition and what it means for the Obama legacy, as well as what is happening with the president-elect and the optics of him moving from citizen to president. My guess...
Can we go back just for a minute to the caller's comment?
We can, but let me just tell people who you are.
And,
I do appreciate your energy, of course. That's Michael Days. He is the editor of the Philadelphia Daily News and author of the new book, Obama's Legacy, What He Accomplished as President. And, of course, in studio with me, Lindsay Perry, political analyst. Okay, Michael. Go right ahead.
I want to go back to something the caller said, and back to what Lindsay's calling about. She doesn't believe that they'll wait until 2020 to implement a new health care plan. I think they absolutely will, because they are all political creatures, and they have to go back to their constituency and be able to argue what's coming next. And they don't really have a plan at this point. They really don't. They've had 7-8 years to come up with something better than Obamacare. But the reality is Obamacare was a Republican plan. It was implemented by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and executed at a very high level. All of this talk has not led them to anything that would make sense, that would replace it. And the reality is, in America now, you've got people who have health care. Even though they're griping about how much they're paying for it, they have health care that they did not have. And in addition,
that's not necessarily true.
Everybody has the ability to keep their child on a plan until they're 26. You know, everybody has the ability to not have an insurer take you off of your health plan because of a pre-existing condition. And people of a certain age all have pre-existing conditions. So, that, I mean, that stuff is real. And so I think it's much more complicated than them just wanting to say, well, our ultimate goal is to erase Obama's legacy.
So I think I want to interject really quickly. I do think that some people in Congress and in the Republican Party, they do want to dismantle it because of the legacy. But I also believe that there is a number of people, regardless if it's Democrat or Republican, that believe that the Affordable Care Act takes out the spirit of the freedom of choice, the freedom to choose if you want to have health care or not. Some people don't prefer just to have health care. I understand you want to ensure the nation, but to have them say if you don't get this Affordable Care plan, you will have to pay a penalty. That is not freedom of choice. That is basically you do this or you don't have the option. And we are a democracy. We have the option to choose how we want to live our lives, and that is the issue.
That's just not true.
That's not true.
When you drive your car, you driving around without insurance.
Some people do. But listen, there are people that would argue, especially doctors. This is all about, I believe this is all about the government finding a free market space to get in and to charge people for insurance. This is a money game, okay? I don't believe it has anything to do with really having the nation, everyone having health care. It sounds good with good and well intentions, and I believe that part of President Obama's implementation was with good and well intention. But when you get all of these other factions in, when you get these high corporate interests, when you get this idea of capitalism, it becomes much more about money and less about people. And that's just my opinion. And I do agree with you. Some people are insured, and there are some people who choose to pay the fine because if they had a pre-existing condition or if they had cancer, their premiums are through the roof and they can't afford to pay that. So the fine during tax season is cheaper than them actually having health insurance, and the copays.
Let me stop.
I'm sorry.
Let's stop
because
let me say that this is not a debate about Obamacare, nor is it a debate about health or the like. What we're talking about, and I think that the reason that it has become so emotional, is that that may be one of the things that is at the very heart of this transition.
Yes.
It is at the very heart of the divide between progressives and conservatives, Democrats, you know, and Republicans, and indeed
one, and people
and well,
go ahead.
Voters. And I think that there are bigger, there are other issues also, because we are about to go undergo an incredible change. Because literally, for the very first time in modern history, we have a non-politician who is coming in as president of the United States. And Michael, can we talk a little bit about the optics again that we saw at the press conference yesterday? We are talking, for example, about, you know, the big controversy about Donald Trump's business interests, blind trust, or half-blind trust, as some could certainly argue, and the fact that he really is still going to be, you know, involved. And the reality is, when you talk about holding him accountable, as we have tried to do in, for presidents past, he's pretty much turned his nose up at that and has done whatever he's wanted to do.
And, you know, I got to say, just as a journalist, somebody who's been practicing journalism for many, many years now, that his use of the term, you know, fake news, anything that he doesn't want to answer, doesn't want to be responsible for, it's fake news. Well, you know, right? He's the master of fake news. Who was the head of the whole birther movement, mm-hmm. nine years ago? It was him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that just pushing the lie, and there's no other thing to say about it, a lie that the current president is not an American citizen. So, you know, I know journalism, we're all trying to figure out how best to cover him in a way that makes some sense and lends some credibility to media, because despite what has been written about him, and most of it I think has been true, a lot of people, including the people who voted for him, just don't care.
Hmm.
So how do we begin to really have some traction and report about him? I mean, I thought, you know, say what you want to say about mainstream media, but I think we pretty much hammered him on not releasing his tax returns, and he just, you know, who's ever not done that?
Yeah, his answer was
they couldn't predict the fact that he was going to get elected, which caused him to question the credibility of mainstream media. They could not
credibility.
I'm not attacking your credibility, but what I'm saying is mainstream media, they did talk about him not releasing his tax returns, but they couldn't predict or even come close to the fact that he would become the president of the United States.
I think it's simpler than that.
Okay.
I think that mainstream media could not have predicted that he would have said no. Because that's what he said before he became president. And I think that the reason that this is such an unusual time when you're talking about, you know, a presidential campaign and the president-elect is that in the past, whether it was, an affair, whether or not it was something that suggested unethical actions and the like, Donald Trump has essentially said no. And no one so far has been able to make him say yes, not even the mainstream media. Can I see your taxes? No. Are you, you know, did this happen? No. Even though, you know, when he's caught in something that is ambiguous or flat out untrue, then he shrugs his shoulders and he keeps going. No one has done that before.
I mean, the only thing he came close to telling the truth on yesterday was he finally has admitted or acknowledged that the Russians were involved in hacking the DNC and other issues. Because I just think the documentation is just so strong, there was no way for him to get around it.
Right.
Yeah. Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jeff, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Jeff, go right ahead. Are you there? Give me a call back, Jeff, if you can. Let's go to let's go to Keith. Keith calling from Baltimore. Hey, Keith, how are you?
All right, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. It's been a while. What's on your mind?
Before President Obama leaves office, on his desk, there is a request for him to pardon Marcus Garvey.
That's
and
true.
Before he comes out of that office, I hope that he would pardon Marcus Garvey, and I also hope that he would pardon, I can't think of the guy's name, but I've been following a lot of it, the American Indian guy that's been in jail for over 40 years for a crime that he didn't commit. And I don't think that there's enough public pressure, or there has not been enough public pressure on Obama to pardon Marcus Garvey. For the new incoming president, from what I saw yesterday on CNN, he's going to diss the media, and he's going to run the media, and he's going to isolate the media the way that he wants to do it. You cannot control a narcissist. And we have to understand that.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for your thoughts about that. Lindsay, your thoughts about what Keith just shared with us.
Well, in terms of pardoning Marcus Garvey, I do believe that that would make a statement, maybe perhaps in his legacy on urban affairs, because I truthfully believe that we had gotten comfortable and there had not been enough public pressure on Obama in terms of the urban community. I do believe that in terms of the urban community, President Obama doesn't really have that great of a legacy. And being a black president, I love. I love seeing a black family in the White House. I love the adoration that he has for this, his family. I love the fact that we as a nation had our first African-American president. But in terms of economic development for urban centers and communities of color, for strategic resources to galvanize the trillions of dollars in African-American communities, in cities like Chicago and Baltimore, the crime rates of us killing each other, with strategies to go in there and help and uplift our communities in addressing the economic distress, I didn't see much of an effort. So pardoning Marcus Garvey is great, but I believe that we were so in love with the fact we had a black president that we forgot we still had to hold people accountable.
Michael, what do you think about that?
Well, I think you're going to be able to compare and contrast very quickly. I thought the president was very aggressive in terms of sending the Justice Department into a number of cities where we had our brothers murdered, and a woman or two murdered, and that's what the Justice Department was very aggressive, much more so than we've seen in a very long time. That's probably going to change. And I guess I take the long view in terms of what he did for African Americans. You know, we're some of the first Americans. We've been here a very long time, and when he was really saving the economy, as we all know, he was handling a horrible economy in 2009, and while we're a long way from Nirvana, it's much, much better than it was in 2009.
What strategic approaches did Obama address in terms of gentrification for the African-American community or communities of color in urban communities? How did he help them not only to gentrify is to remove a people? How did we help them to actually uplift themselves so that they wouldn't have to move? How did he respond to bank interest rates? How did he respond to foreclosure rates in urban communities?
Well, hold on, because I was about to defend you earlier.
Okay. Now you're going to get on my case.
But then you blew it.
Well, how did I blow it?
In your defense, I think that, what Michael said about sending the Justice Department in, where African-Americans had been killed by police officers. Yes.
That was great.
Yes, it was, but it was a reaction.
Exactly.
Yeah, what and in defense of what you're saying and your original point, we see that there may be a problem in our urban centers, and so yes, where were the jobs? Where were the dare I say the government work, programs? And I'm not talking about welfare.
I'm
talking about contracts and buildings.
Yes.
And so certainly
infrastructure
and even the National Urban League just this week released a report saying that the Small Business Administration under the Obama administration did not do as well as it could have, although they do not necessarily place blame directly on the president. So there's an issue. But when you're talking about, some of the other issues and the economy, I don't think people really realize, and Michael, you can certainly talk about this on the other side. I don't think people really realize how close America was, not to the Great a greater recession, but a great depression, worse than we saw in 1929. We can talk about that on the other side. And also when we come back, we're going to talk to Eugene calling from White Marsh and Brian in Northwest, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about the tradition of transition and what it means for the Obama legacy and the incoming Trump administration. Before the break, we were talking, debating with Lindsay Michael about the economy and the Obama legacy. Talk to me about that.
You know, President Obama is leaving Trump with the economy in very good shape. When he took over in 2009, unemployment was about 7-8%. It actually rose to 10% during his first year as president. Now the overall unemployment is under 5%. Now, you know, for black folks, it's probably closer to 9-10%. And unfortunately, that's been consistent forever. But things are much better. If you look at we were losing about 800,000 jobs. We just lost 800,000 jobs when he took over. Those numbers are gone. The unemployment rate, like I said, is under 5%. The stock market is doing incredibly well. There was growth in jobs, repeated growth in jobs every month for 7 years. I mean, that was a lot of work. A great deal of work. And if he had not, you know, one of the things I did when I started working on this book, I went back and really read a lot about 1929, 1930, the last, you know, Great Depression. Things were horrible. People were throwing themselves off of buildings. People were in bread lines. People were losing their houses. Banks were foreclosing. It was a disaster.
But they're not committing suicide because of the stock market. No, not because of the stock market. That's the stock market. But fast forward to today, some people are in an economic depression. Some of our communities are economically depressed. And because they're economically depressed, you do see a higher rate of suicide. It is difficult for some people. And I understand things may look better on the surface. You know, people would like to paint this picture. Oh my goodness, you know, everyone is doing great. But you walk into some communities like Chicago, like in Midwest Ohio, and I am from Toledo, Ohio, so there are black people there. Things are not as gravy as they may seem.
Okay, but let's
and
talk
I don't
about
think anybody's go, trying to portray that. I live in downtown Trenton, New Jersey. It's a little this
and you
that.
Should know.
People are still struggling.
Camden, yes.
But hold on,
but
and let,
things are much better economically than they would have. And you can't even begin to imagine what life would be like on this planet if the economy had not been turned around.
Let me go to the phone lines. Brian calling from Northwest. What's on your mind, Brian?
Hey, I'm calling from Northwest DC. Let me make a few quick points.
Real quick. Go ahead.
If they dismantle Obamacare, whatever they want to call it, it's still Obamacare because 20 million people will go back on it, whatever means they use, and he should get the credit for that. But I serve on a board in Washington, D.C., D.C. FHA board, and we receive hundreds of million dollars from President Obama called a Save the Home program, in which we use his dollars and his bonds to save foreclosure throughout Washington, D.C., and we was just to grant it another $100 million worth of bonds, and every city got these bonds to save people homes. So when you talk about economic impact, we was given that. Also, directly, construction firms at the Small Business Association was given bond waivers up to $6 million per project. That means that we was able to bid on, instead of smaller projects, larger projects. So economic impact from that, his administration directly affected the people in Washington, D.C., and I believe the government is local. Local politics.
Absolutely.
We should all be involved in it.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Brian. I appreciate that. Eugene, calling from White Marsh, what's on your mind?
I wanted to make a comment regarding the DNC and I think the mistake they made during the presidential election. I think the biggest mistake they made initially was being determined, hell-bent on having Hillary Clinton be the candidate. I mean, that was the biggest problem. It was clear. It's one thing to have an idea in mind. And keep in mind, back in 2008, Hillary Clinton was supposed to be the presidential candidate. Then Obama came, charmed everybody. He took the role. Bernie Sanders was doing something similar. Look, you can dress up somebody. You can put them out there, and you can try to promote them all you want. You go with what the public is telling you. And when young people, educated folks, are gravitating towards a candidate, like they were towards Bernie Sanders, you go with that.
You and listen to the kids.
And when they decided, come hell or high water, they were determined to have her in there, it disenchanted a lot of folks. It disenchanted a lot of folks that never returned.
Hmm. Okay. Eugene, thank you so much. And to that point, one of the things that that I think has been critical to the problems with the Democrats, particularly in this last campaign, if not even before that, with the Obama White House, is the inability to develop a narrative, mm-hmm. to tell the story of those, you know, successes and the like, that, you know, that Morning in America piece that Ronald Reagan did so exceptionally well, you know, right. during the 1980s. And the Republicans have always of late seemed to be able to tell a great story. Michael, why can't the Democrats seem to do the Bill Clinton-esque thing that he did during the convention was, you know, once upon a time I met a girl, you know?
Yeah. I think you've been hitting the nail on the head there. I mean, what was the Democratic narrative? What was Hillary Clinton's narrative? She was responding to Trump. Trump is horrible. Trump, you know, how could we even think about electing him? When we came to find out that the people who elected him really did not care. You didn't know what her narrative was, what was important to her. The other thing was, I mean, I think hardly anybody would disagree with this, that she did not campaign where she needed to campaign.
Exactly.
She really only lost the three main states she needed to have, totally, by 80,000 votes.
Hillary losing was a miscalculation of a constituency.
She had to carry Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, I think the other one was Minnesota, mm-hmm. and she couldn't pull it off because there was no... I mean, I think we'd all be hard-pressed to say, here's what she stood for.
Well, we don't know exactly what her issues were. I agree with you. We don't know exactly what her issues were because her whole campaign was ran against Trump.
Right.
And you can't run against, you have to be pro because your constituency, right. We have real issues, right? We want to know exactly what you're going to do for our communities, how you're going to put more money in our pockets, how you're going to help our children. And she miscalculated her constituency.
Well, suffice it to say, and to that point, to simplify it, she was never in a position from the beginning to say, this is who I am. She was always in a position to say, this is what he's doing.
Yeah, and this is who I am. There were a lot of people that don't really have a lot of trust for Hillary Clinton, weren't feeling her at all. She was a horrible candidate. I agree with the caller.
Well, both candidates
are horrible. Yes, but we're talking about bad. Somebody's going to be
the lesser of two evils.
The lesser of two evils. Two parties. We need, and I say this. I want to say this for the urban community. Just like Bob Johnson says, no friends, no enemies, common interests. We need to be in the room. I don't care if it's Democrat, Republican. We need to be. We need to have a seat at the table because the color line is not black and white, it's green.
But as we have seen from the cabinet picks, we are not in the room. And right now, there is only one...
Dr. Ben Carson is in the room.
As I said, right now, and you could argue that he's being picked for the black job. Because it's
a black job.
It's the black job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a black job, you're right. The first
okay,
secretary
so, but why not? But why not have... you know, the black guy or the black woman in a job that is that has traditionally not been held by an African American.
At this point, what African Americans do you know are going to serve in that administration? Because there, some people probably would, but they're probably terrified to come out and speak out and say that they would.
Who has been asked?
Yeah.
Well,
and I don't think hardly anybody.
No. To your point, right after Donald Trump was, and this is not, oh, I'm pro Donald Trump, but right after Donald Trump was elected for the presidency, he called Bob Johnson to have a meeting with him to actually sit down and say, hey, how can we help urban communities? This is a man, the color line is green, people, but he also is a black man. Now, Bob Johnson definitely didn't want a seat in the administration, and he felt more comfortable handling things outside. But that is to have a seat at the table, to have a room, to have this man call him. I think we need to take a look at that. I'm just saying.
But again, if those are the only two black folks, you know.
But we don't know that. We don't know that. He's met with Kanye West. He's met with Jim Brown. He's met with Kanye West. What is wrong with Kanye West? Yeah, young people love Kanye West, and you better listen to the millennials because he's a genius.
Yeah, but do you really want him running that? Come on.
We have changed. This country has changed. We have no idea what's going to happen in 2020.
And we most certainly would not have an idea of Kanye West.
We didn't think Trump would be the president. We didn't think Trump would be the president. You better think again. We said the same thing.
And let us say that if nothing else, this could very well be one of the most interesting presidencies of modern times. Fun. I debate that.
It ignites a fire in people. You're going to see people organizing, regardless of the fact if you like his politics or not. What we need is fire. We need people out there, you know, having a voice. So
on that, I agree with you. I'm
excited.
To galvanize now and organize. Say we need to be thinking about midterm. But when have you heard people talking about midterm?
We don't.
Never.
Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And I think that we are going to see not just interesting activity, you know, from the White House. I think we're going to see interesting activity on Capitol Hill, particularly from the Republicans who are, some could argue, are holding their nose and saying that they are supporting the administration. So, yeah. I think it's going to be absolutely, fascinating, you know, particularly from, you know, journalist and observer point of view. Look, I want to thank
both
of you. Hey, there you go.
Yeah, so it's going to be fun because people are going to make money.
Let us hope that we all have a chance to do that.
Hold on, we'll have to talk about that fun piece a little later.
Yeah, exactly.
This is fun to me. We could do this all day.
Lindsay Perry, Michael Days, thank you both so very much.
For
I appreciate you all participating in this conversation, and I'm sure we're going to be talking again real
soon. Well, the conversation has been fun, so thank you so much.
There you go. Thank you so much. That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Thursday, January 12th, 2017. I'm Harold Fisher. You can reach me on Facebook at Harold Fisher WHUR or Twitter at H Fisher WHUR. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, Sirius XM Channel 142, HBCU and Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.